Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education. November Examination Session 2004. English as a Second Language. Paper 4. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, center number, and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the tape to be louder, tell your teacher now. The tape will not be stopped while you are doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers. And when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the tape back on. Now you are all ready, here is the test. Look at the questions for part one. There are 6 questions in this part of the exam. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. You will hear each item twice. Part 1. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. Why is the plane late?
Hello, I'm going to be late. My flight's been delayed because of ice on the runway. Hello, I'm going to be late. My flight's been delayed because of ice on the runway.
Question 2. Charlene wants to visit the castle. What must she find first?
Excuse me, how do I get to the castle?
Oh, you are a long way away. Go straight ahead to the pedestrian zone, over there in front of the supermarket. You will see the castle up above you and then simply climb up the steps to it.
Excuse me, how do I get to the castle?
Oh, you are a long way away. Go straight ahead to the pedestrian zone, over there in front of the supermarket. You will see the castle up above you and then simply climb up the steps to it.
Question 3. Martin is boarding his train to Milan. But where must he be sure to sit, and why?
The train at platform 14 is the 11:33 to Milan. Passengers for Milan, please sit in the front 5 coaches. This train divides at Basel. The train at platform 14 is the 11:33 to Milan. Passengers for Milan, please sit in the front 5 coaches. This train divides at Basel.
Question 4. Which is the best place for Mariam to purchase a drink and a snack?
Excuse me, where could I buy something to eat and drink that's not too far away, please?
Well, there's the University Cafe, but that's a couple of kilometres away on the other side of the city. There's the Town Hall Cafe, but that is far too expensive. I know. Why don't you try that new place called the Happy Coffee Bean? It's ideal. It's just opposite the swimming pool.
Excuse me, where could I buy something to eat and drink that's not too far away, please?
Well, there's the University Cafe, but that's a couple of kilometres away on the other side of the city. There's the Town Hall Cafe, but that is far too expensive. I know. Why don't you try that new place called the Happy Coffee Bean? It's ideal. It's just opposite the swimming pool.
Question 5. John has arrived for his sailing lesson. Why was sailing cancelled?
Hello. Where are all the boats and where is everyone else?
Hello, John. We tried to telephone you and warn you not to come. Sailing is cancelled today because the wind is too strong. Sorry. Perhaps it will be calmer tomorrow and you'll be able to sail then instead.
Hello. Where are all the boats and where is everyone else?
Hello, John. We tried to telephone you and warn you not to come. Sailing is cancelled today because the wind is too strong. Sorry. Perhaps it will be calmer tomorrow and you'll be able to sail then instead.
Question 6. Ben is returning to the Maldives after a 12-month stay in Namibia. What do his friends decide to do for him, and why?
Ben is leaving next Sunday, and he's really sad about it.
Let's give him a surprise party.
Yes, and at the end, let's give him some photographs of us all to remind him of our times together. That will cheer him up. Ben is leaving next Sunday, and he's really sad about it.
Let's give him a surprise party.
Yes, and at the end, let's give him some photographs of us all to remind him of our times together. That will cheer him up.
That is the last question in part one. In a moment, you will hear part two. Now look at the questions for part two, exercise one. Part 2. Exercise 1. Question 7. Listen to the following interview with a young orchestra conductor and then fill in the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Hello and welcome to Music Time. Today we're going to meet a young gentleman who has a great responsibility. He's the conductor of a large national orchestra. Georg Ramon, welcome to the programme. Can you tell us what being a conductor means?
Certainly. I stand in front of the orchestra with my back to the audience, and I make sure that each group of instruments keeps in time with the other groups.
How many players are we talking about?
I have to check that 80 to 100 people are all playing at the same speed.
Oh. And is that all?
No. I interpret the music and the dynamics. That's the loud and soft sounds, the mood of the piece.
Mm.
I put my own ideas into how it should be performed, and of course that would be different from other conductors' ideas on the same piece.
However do you accomplish all that?
Using my hands and a baton, a little conducting stick which I hold and wave about. In rehearsals or practices, I can speak to the musicians and tell them what I want to do. But during a concert, I can only use my hands, facial expressions, and body language.
Mm. Can you hear everything that's being played all at once by every instrument?
Well, yes. That comes with years of practice. And that is the conductor's role, to hear everything in case someone persists in playing a wrong note. You hear everything and divide the parts up in your mind to find out which instrument is playing the wrong note.
Do you play an instrument yourself?
Yes, I play the trumpet. I've been learning it since I was 6 years old.
And when did you decide to become a conductor?
At university. I was studying music there and kept taking over rehearsals, so friends kept advising me to become a conductor.
Did you have to study specially for it?
Yes, 3 years at music college after my degree.
Mm. What's your ambition?
To make music accessible to everyone, so that every age group will enjoy it.
Georg Ramon, thank you for bringing music into our studio.
Now you will hear the interview again. Hello and welcome to Music Time. Today we're going to meet a young gentleman who has a great responsibility. He's the conductor of a large national orchestra. Georg Ramon, welcome to the programme. Can you tell us what being a conductor means?
Certainly. I stand in front of the orchestra with my back to the audience, and I make sure that each group of instruments keeps in time with the other groups.
How many players are we talking about?
I have to check that 80 to 100 people are all playing at the same speed.
Oh. And is that all?
No, no. I interpret the music and the dynamics. That's the loud and soft sounds, the mood of the piece.
Mm.
I put my own ideas into how it should be performed, and of course that would be different from other conductors' ideas on the same piece.
However do you accomplish all that?
Using my hands and a baton, a little conducting stick which I hold and wave about. In rehearsals or practices, I can speak to the musicians and tell them what I want to do, but during a concert, I can only use my hands, facial expressions, and body language.
Mm. Can you hear everything that's being played all at once by every instrument?
Well, yes. That comes with years of practice. And that is the conductor's role, to hear everything in case someone persists in playing a wrong note. You hear everything and divide the parts up in your mind to find out which instrument is playing the wrong note.
Do you play an instrument yourself?
Yes, I play the trumpet. I've been learning it since I was 6 years old.
And when did you decide to become a conductor?
At university. I was studying music there and kept taking over rehearsals, so friends kept advising me to become a conductor.
Did you have to study specially for it?
Yes, 3 years at music college after my degree.
Mm. What's your ambition?
To make music accessible to everyone, so that every age group will enjoy it.
Georg Ramon, thank you for bringing music into our studio. That is the end of Part 2, Exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear Part 2, Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2. Part 2, Exercise 2. Question 8. Listen to the following interview about a rose growing in Kenya, and then fill in the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Hello, and welcome to Kenya. I'm glad that you can join me here to meet Nick Ramotswe, the manager of a local rose farm. Nick, tell us about your trade.
Thank you. I run Rose Farm. It is on the shores of Lake Nakuru, right in the middle of Kenya, and surrounded by a variety of wildlife. Hippos, pelicans, and giraffes, for example. We specialize in exporting homegrown roses all around the world.
Why roses?
Roses are so lovely. They have a special meaning when given as a gift. They can express thanks, love, or congratulations, and are so beautifully scented. They use all our senses.
So, how many do you grow?
Lots. Our farm spreads over 35 hectares. That's about the size of 35 football pitches. And we have to cut nearly 800,000 rose stems per week. The roses are usually at their destination within 60 hours of being picked, wrapped in foam, of course, to protect their delicate petals. Otherwise, they would arrive crushed and bruised.
You aim for top quality?
Yes, we aim for the best. The fresher the roses are, the better.
Is Kenya ideally suited for rose growing, then?
We think so. We only have two seasons, and the lake is a plentiful water supply for us. We have good daytime temperatures and cool nights. We are 5,000 feet above sea level, so that makes our roses more hardy and guarantees that they will last longer for the customer.
Rose growing must be a complicated process.
Yes, from preparing rose beds to planting, caring and feeding. Rose growing for us is on a 70-day cycle.
Do you have many employees?
Yes, 3 for every 70,000 roses. It doesn't sound many, does it? But it means we have a large number of employees.
When do you harvest the roses?
7 o'clock each morning. Then the roses go to the packing house and are graded according to the size and perfection of each. You must see them there, ready to be sent. Lovely colours, yellows, pinks, deep reds and peaches. Beautiful. And always the overwhelming fragrance.
Modern roses don't have much scent, do they?
No, and because of that, we're trying to breed more fragrant roses. That is what the customer wants, you know.
Obviously, you are a major employer in your community.
Oh, yes, we provide work. We work alongside other growers sharing transport and production methods, and most of all, we give local people a chance to raise their standard of living by providing regular employment.
Nick, many thanks. Now you will hear the interview again. Hello and welcome to Kenya. I'm glad that you can join me here to meet Nick Ramotswe, the manager of a local rose farm. Nick, tell us about your trade.
Thank you. I run Rose Farm. It is on the shores of Lake Nakuru, right in the middle of Kenya, and surrounded by a variety of wildlife. Hippos, pelicans and giraffes, for example. We specialize in exporting homegrown roses all around the world.
Why roses?
Roses are so lovely. They have a special meaning when given as a gift. They can express thanks, love, or congratulations, and are so beautifully scented. They use all our senses.
So, how many do you grow?
Lots. Our farm spreads over 35 hectares. That's about the size of 35 football pitches. And we have to cut nearly 800,000 rose stems per week. The roses are usually at their destination within 60 hours of being picked, wrapped in foam, of course, to protect their delicate petals. Otherwise, they would arrive crushed and bruised.
You aim for top quality?
Yes, we aim for the best. The fresher the roses are, the better.
Is Kenya ideally suited for rose growing, then?
We think so. We only have 2 seasons, and the lake is a plentiful water supply for us. We have good daytime temperatures and cool nights. We are 5,000 feet above sea level, so that makes our roses more hardy and guarantees that they will last longer for the customer.
Rose growing must be a complicated process.
Yes, from preparing rose beds to planting, caring and feeding. Rose growing for us is on a 70-day cycle.
Do you have many employees?
Yes, 3 for every 70,000 roses. It doesn't sound many, does it? But it means we have a large number of employees.
When do you harvest the roses?
7 o'clock each morning. Then the roses go to the packing house and are graded according to the size and perfection of each. You must see them there, ready to be sent. Lovely colours, yellows, pinks, deep reds and peaches. Beautiful. And always the overwhelming fragrance.
Modern roses don't have much scent, do they?
No, and because of that, we're trying to breed more fragrant roses. That is what the customer wants, you know.
Obviously, you are a major employer in your community.
Oh, yes, we provide work. We work alongside other growers sharing transport and production methods, and most of all, we give local people a chance to raise their standard of living by providing regular employment.
Nick, many thanks. That is the end of part 2.
In a moment, you will hear part three. Now look at the questions for part three, exercise one. Part 3. Part 3, Exercise 1. Question 9. Listen to the following interview about Istanbul in Turkey, and then answer the questions below. You will hear the interview twice.
Hello, and welcome to Food File. And this week, we are in Istanbul. I'm here to meet a famous cookery writer, Sida Nas, a native of the country, and to discover the delights of this historic city. Sida, Istanbul is unique, isn't it?
I certainly think so. For a start, it spans two continents. It is in both Europe and Asia, you know. I grew up here, and my grandfather used to tell us the most wonderful stories. My family at that time lived on the shores of the Bosphorus Straits in a little village which is now part of the city. Did you know that Istanbul is one of the largest cities in the world? Of course, it also has the best food in the Middle East, but then I am biased, as I've just written a book about it.
Oh, the smell of fresh baking here has made me hungry. Can we try some?
Certainly. Let's begin the day with this. It's called baklava, and is a sweet made of about 40 layers of pastry, and you could eat it with some of this nice buffalo milk cream. Mmm, delicious.
Oh, lovely. What next?
Well, let's walk on. The streets here are always jammed with cars and people crossing the Golden Horn into the old part of the city.
What's there to see?
Mosques, ancient palaces, and very old streets, which seem to be tumbling down as we look at them. But they're all still lived in, and a very important part of the life, tourism and culture of the big city. You really feel the past here. It's like living history.
Oh, yes.
Istanbul is nearly 1,700 years old now. Look, that's the Blue Mosque up on the hill of the old city.
Ah.
Inside, it is decorated by 21,000 priceless turquoise tiles. There's the cathedral over there that was built in the 6th century, and then there is the palace, too.
Let's have a look at the market.
We call it a bazaar, and it is an important part of the city's life, too. We call this a city within the big city, as inside, the number of shops has increased to over 5,000. Tourists from all over the world visit here and try to barter for a good bargain. The bazaar was started in 1458, and it doesn't look a lot different today, really. It is such an interesting place to shop.
We could cross over to Asia from Europe for lunch.
Let's do that. From here, we can sit and eat while looking across the water. The pace of life in Asia seems much calmer than in the European side of the city. It seems more rural here.
We can return to Europe by ferry across the water, can't we?
Yes. Passengers are always served refreshing black tea on that journey, too. But before that, I want to find the little street here where my grandmother used to live. It must be just over there. I know that the house is no longer there, but this is definitely the area. I do love it here. There are times when you're by the Bosphorus that you feel it is the best place on earth to be.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Hello, and welcome to Food File. And this week, we are in Istanbul. I'm here to meet a famous cookery writer, Sida Nas, a native of the country, and to discover the delights of this historic city. Sida, Istanbul is unique, isn't it?
I certainly think so. For a start, it spans two continents. It is in both Europe and Asia, you know. I grew up here, and my grandfather used to tell us the most wonderful stories. My family at that time lived on the shores of the Bosphorus Straits, in a little village which is now part of the city. Did you know that Istanbul is one of the largest cities in the world? Of course, it also has the best food in the Middle East, but then I am biased, as I've just written a book about it.
Oh, the smell of fresh baking here has made me hungry. Can we try some?
Certainly. Let's begin the day with this. It's called baklava, and is a sweet made of about 40 layers of pastry, and you could eat it with some of this nice buffalo milk cream. Mmm, delicious.
Oh, lovely. What next?
Well, let's walk on. The streets here are always jammed with cars and people crossing the Golden Horn into the old part of the city.
What's there to see?
Mosques, ancient palaces, and very old streets, which seem to be tumbling down as we look at them. But they're all still lived in, and a very important part of the life, tourism and culture of the big city. You really feel the past here. It's like living history.
Oh, yes.
Istanbul is nearly 1,700 years old now. Look, that's the Blue Mosque up on the hill of the old city. Inside, it is decorated by 21,000 priceless turquoise tiles. There's the cathedral over there that was built in the 6th century, and then there is the palace, too.
Let's have a look at the market.
We call it a bazaar, and it is an important part of the city's life, too. We call this a city within the big city, as inside, the number of shops has increased to over 5,000. Tourists from all over the world visit here and try to barter for a good bargain. The bazaar was started in 1458, and it doesn't look a lot different today, really. It is such an interesting place to shop.
We could cross over to Asia from Europe for lunch.
Let's do that. From here, we can sit and eat while looking across the water. The pace of life in Asia seems much calmer than in the European side of the city. It seems more rural here.
We can return to Europe by ferry across the water, can't we?
Yes. Passengers are always served refreshing black tea on that journey, too. But before that, I want to find the little street here where my grandmother used to live. It must be just over there. I know that the house is no longer there, but this is definitely the area. I do love it here. There are times when you're by the Bosphorus that you feel it is the best place on earth to be.
That is the end of Part 3, Exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2. Part 3, Exercise 2. Question 10. Listen to the following interview with a Formula One driver from India, and then answer the questions below. You will hear the interview twice.
is a Formula One racetrack resounding to a fast practice session. I'm here to meet India's number one Formula One driver, Nan Kumar, who currently drives for Jaguar. Nan, tell us about the role of car racing in your life.
I was born in 1976, January the 14th to be precise, so I'm 28 and I come from Western India. I always loved riding bikes, and when I was old enough, I purchased my first bike with an engine, 50cc capacity. I was fascinated by speed, and especially by Formula One. That has always been my goal. It's easier said than done to follow that as a career, though. And before all of that, before I could even consider racing, I had to convince my mother that safety measures are taken very seriously in this sport.
But you have achieved your ambition now.
I think I'm the first Indian ever to drive a Formula One racing car in professional racing conditions. My timings are good too, you know. Nearly as good as Finland's Häkkinen or Germany's Schumacher.
What's your fastest speed then?
304.5 kilometers per hour. That was really fast. I was driving 15 laps at the time, and my 13th lap was at the top speed.
You must hold the record as the fastest Indian person in the world. Do you hold any titles?
Last year I won a Grand Prix in Asia.
Have you had any accidents?
Yes, in India. On this occasion, I started last because I had a problem releasing the brakes on my car. The red lights went out and the green start of race lights came on. I shot off the grid at high speed and realized amazingly that I was now in the lead. But I was going too fast, and I hit a curb too hard and spun off on one of the track corners. Luckily, I wasn't hurt.
How have you got to your high status, do you think?
My parents have always supported me, and it was they who originally sent me for proper safe training for the sport. I recognize their contribution and sacrifice, and so I've always worked hard in response.
How would you encourage others who are aiming at the top of their field?
Keep working and be determined to reach your goal. There's no other way.
Nan, thank you for talking to us about your life. Now you will hear the interview again. Good evening. The roar behind me is a Formula One racetrack resounding to a fast practice session. I'm here to meet India's number one Formula One driver, Nan Kumar, who currently drives for Jaguar. Nan, tell us about the role of car racing in your life.
I was born in 1976, January the 14th to be precise, so I'm 28 and I come from Western India. I always loved riding bikes, and when I was old enough, I purchased my first bike with an engine, 50cc capacity. I was fascinated by speed, and especially by Formula One. That has always been my goal. It's easier said than done to follow that as a career, though. And before all of that, before I could even consider racing, I had to convince my mother that safety measures are taken very seriously in this sport.
But you have achieved your ambition now.
I think I'm the first Indian ever to drive a Formula One racing car in professional racing conditions. My timings are good too, you know. Nearly as good as Finland's Häkkinen or Germany's Schumacher.
What's your fastest speed then?
304.5 kilometers per hour. That was really fast. I was driving 15 laps at the time, and my 13th lap was at the top speed.
You must hold the record as the fastest Indian person in the world. Do you hold any titles?
Last year I won a Grand Prix in Asia.
Have you had any accidents?
Yes, in India. On this occasion, I started last because I had a problem releasing the brakes on my car. The red lights went out, and the green start of race lights came on. I shot off the grid at high speed and realized amazingly that I was now in the lead. But I was going too fast, and I hit a curb too hard and spun off on one of the track corners. Luckily, I wasn't hurt.
How have you got to your high status, do you think?
My parents have always supported me, and it was they who originally sent me for proper safe training for the sport. I recognize their contribution and sacrifice, and so I've always worked hard in response.
How would you encourage others who are aiming at the top of their field?
Keep working and be determined to reach your goal. There's no other way.
Nan, thank you for talking to us about your life. That is the end of part 3 and of the test. In a moment, your teacher will stop the tape and collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, center number, and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, the tape should now be stopped, and all the papers collected. Thank you, everyone.